Hello and welcome to the Shifting Lens podcast, where we are viewing the animal experience. I'm joined by Molly and Tiamat, and today we're discussing non-human presidential companions. I first got excited about this topic when I found out there was once a raccoon living in the White House, but that sent us down a rabbit hole, so to speak, of all of the interesting non-human companions that have lived with politicians and how our perceptions of the humans are affected by their animal companions. So to start, I'll throw the spotlight to Molly to introduce Rebecca the raccoon.
Thanks, Rebecca, the human. I know, like it's just so darn interesting when I think it was around Thanksgiving this popped up. So we're only getting to touch on this like 6 months after it came up. But I was like, oh yeah, wasn't there like a raccoon in the White House? So no, I find this stuff fascinating because, you know, we think about, you know, in the news, we hear about the president's dogs or they're, you know, they're looking for a cat or things like that. And, you know, non-traditional animals are the thing that kind of get me more excited. So that's what kind of perked my interest. But yeah, the Coolidges. Yeah, they were the ones that had Rebecca the raccoon and actually Reuben the raccoon. I think that's so interesting. They were given, well, Rebecca at least was given as, yeah, Thanksgiving dinner. So another cultural piece that we don't think about is the consumption of raccoon historically. But I think it's pretty awesome that they were like, no, we're going to keep it. And it's going to be a pet and it's going to be trouble, which I mean, raccoons are, which is fascinating. I think also interesting at the time, rabies wasn't a big concern. So that's another reason I think it was relatively okay for them to keep it.
We were talking about before we hit the record button about why are there less exotic, in inverted commas, animals in the White House in this case. And do you think that zoonotic diseases might have something to do with that? That this like awareness of that might play a role?
It's interesting. I think it's going to be pure speculation until one of us or one of our awesome listeners digs around in the law and what changed culturally. Because just in going through presidential pets, you know, White House animals, as it were, it looks like more exotic critters were the norm up through FDR. Well, not even FDR, because he just had a lot of dogs. But I'll say Herbert Hoover, because Herbert Hoover was the last, it looks like, to have truly exotic animals with two alligators. So pre-Herbert Hoover, this was not that uncommon, but something changed after him where this was not so normal. So was it the people coming through the White House? Was it the unwillingness to basically run a zoo or a menagerie out of the White House? Was it zoonotic disease? It's super interesting. You know, we were chatting a little bit before about, you know, was there a line? Because I mean, we've got, like I said, the pair of alligators that President Hoover's technically his son had, but Calvin Coolidge had a bobcat. Like, who else do we have in here? A lot of livestock, tremendous amount of livestock. Taft had a cow at the White House. But then, I mean, everyone remembers Teddy Roosevelt and all of his animals. I mean, he had bears, he had all sorts of snakes and parrots and a zebra and cats and a hyena and a lion and all sorts of things. And I mean, historically people have made a spectacle out of that, but I think it's interesting that, you know, we had a president with all of those critters.
I wonder what role horses play in this, because if we think of horses as the symbol of freedom, especially in the States, especially as the Mustang, as we spoke about in a previous podcast, these symbols of the Wild West and the true America, whatever that means, and those sort of romanticized, you know, versions of it, and having the horses be that symbol. I wonder, did that come up in your searches there of non-traditional companions? Did horses come up as a really common one?
It did. Carriage horses, especially going back into the 1800s, were extremely common. Grant had race horses, carriage horses, tons of horses. Hayes had horses. They come up so much, but it stops right around John F. Kennedy. So the Kennedys had horses, and then post the Kennedys, horses weren't common. So, I mean, certainly we didn't use horses at that point, but it does seem like primarily horses were at the White House when it was normal you know, use of horses, and then that significantly dropped off until a little peak with the Kennedys having horses, and then that dropped off. So yeah, I think functionality might go into a little bit, or just at least cultural norms, I think, are a big piece of this as well, is what's going to be, what is exotic, what is normal and functional, and then just the pet, and then that huge increase in dogs, a little bit of cats, a little bit of birds, canaries, a couple parrots here and there, but it really diminishes down, like not even really, I don't think there's been a White House gecko, I don't think, or a bearded dragon. Snakes significantly dropped off as well. So it really shifted to that cat dog dichotomy in the, really the especially the 40s, 50s, 60s, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's so interesting. I can't get enough of looking at these lists.
I wonder if that comes along with that American dream, like the white picket fence, the dog and the cat, the housewife and the two kids, and I don't know.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that I think that American dream representation is a big piece of this. You know, and now that you mentioned it, thinking back, a lot of our presidents that were much more, let's go see the West, let's go see, you know, all of that, let's go be explorers, as well as presidents, probably played a little bit more into the freedom to have less traditional animals. But going into that American dream, I also think, you know, part of what interested us in having this conversation was the news about Biden's dog Major and him getting into trouble. And again, like, what is allowed at the White House? And it's so fascinating because one of the things that's come up, obviously, is that Biden has, at least in some way, shape, or form, made mouth contact, so many different versions of that story, with some Secret Service. And it didn't take long to do a little bit of research and find out that, in fact, he's not the first Major the dog to bite someone at the White House, that FDR's German Shepherd, also named Major, also got into a little bit of trouble. It seems that he bit three different people at the White House, and included tearing the pants off of a British prime minister. So
as one does.
Yes, as one does. I mean, I think that sounds appropriate, maybe. I don't know. I never
met the prime minister. Clearly he's very patriotic.
Yes, yes. So, and I mean, eventually that behavior was not permissible and he was sent back to the family residence in Hyde Park. But I think there's something to be said for that too, is that if we could have hyenas at the White House and that was somehow okay, and now we have dogs that are getting themselves in trouble and eventually that gets you dismissed from your service at the White House, like, I think that's interesting where those cultural norms land. Tima, what have you sort of learned about with cultural norms and illustrious presidential pets?
Well, I think the whole thing with Biden is quite interesting as well in terms of what we expect those dogs to perform and how we expect them to display themselves. Because as folks like, you know, Coulter and so on state, like all animals are workers, like whether human or other animals, we're all working. And especially when you're looking at dogs living in the White House and they're presidential, and how are we expecting them to display themselves? And I think there's that role of having the spotlight on them, and how do we want their demeanors to be? How much effort do they need to perform in to perform emotional labor? And I think in this case, it's doubled or tripled or quadrupled even by the fact that Major is a German Shepherd, because there is that extra spotlight put on him with that image that German Shepherds have. So whether we want to call that breedism or not, but there is that emphasis on his behavior. And I think that's, it would be interesting to think about if, you know, if he was a Labrador or if he was even like a smaller breed, how that would come across with everyone. You know, would he have been sent away? Would it be called an aggressive attack or a disgrace or anything like that if it was a different dog? So I think that was something that popped out for me about that. But also, you're mentioning this change in who is being seen as a companion, or who we're seeing pop up in the White House alongside the presidents. And with one of the former presidents recently, Trump, it was that whole conversation of why doesn't he have that, you know, furry companion or scaly companion or feathered one. And I thought that was interesting as well. And we mentioned this before we recorded of him saying, oh, he doesn't have enough time. And then we hear about, well, some of them had hyenas and bears, so there must be some way to have an animal in the house. Or saying that he doesn't want to have a dog because he felt it came across as being phony, and that his people, in inverted commas, didn't have that kind of relationship with him where he needed to be phony with them. And I think in that case, it's also interesting that contrast of that absence of the companion, and also how he's using dogs in a negative way. So not only are they absent, but he's almost weaponizing that symbol, that aggressive side of the dog that we maybe see or is presented in through Major now with that bite, but this kind of, he got fired like a dog or dumped like a dog, however he worded that. Also the then leader of the Islamic State being, you know, dying like a dog. And how does that come across then to people who do live with dogs? And the dogs are normally surrounded by, hopefully, with their loved ones, whether it's at the vet or at home, dying like a dog. What does that even mean? Why are you presenting it in that way? And what does that say about how he sees it, as well as how he empathizes with folks who, are living with dogs? But also through saying that, in a way, ignoring the dogs who work for him, who are part of the Special Forces unit the canine unit, but worked with the Special Forces to pursue this man. So I think that's, again, kind of comes back towards like the work dogs do in the White House, as well as they do with the Special Forces, and how they were being presented so differently in both cases, like with Trump being used as like a negative thing. And with Biden, again, we're seeing that effect of not really acknowledging them as working and needing to be prepared for it as well. You don't just come in knowing how to take on that role, especially if you're a German Shepherd and you're more sensitive to emotional attachments and shifts in that, or having to adjust to having a hustle and bustle around you. So I'm not sure, did you have anything you wanted to bring into that, Rebecca, in terms of how people perceive the companions that are hanging out in the White House?
Absolutely. I think another important thing that ties into what you're saying, Tiamat, is the fact that Major was a shelter dog, a rescue, and a German Shepherd. Those are compounding on the expectations that we had for him just as people. And I have to wonder how many times there's been contact bites by dogs in the White House that we just don't hear about, because maybe the expectations for perfect behavior are less. And the fact that he's a rescue problematizes his behavior before it even happens. And the fact that he's a German Shepherd makes him seem more dangerous before anything happens. So when there is a minor incident, I feel like, I don't want to say blown out of proportion, because I don't want to be insensitive to the person who was harmed and fear was caused by these incidents. But at the same time, I question if there would have been the same response had it been a Yorkie that had a contact bite, you know, that came from a breeder and we could trace its papers. And I just think that there's a lot of layers there associated with Major as a shelter dog, and the way that he was almost made to be an ambassador both for German Shepherds and for White House dogs, but also as a rescue. This is the first time that we've really discussed a rescue being in the White House as this important indicator of empathy for Biden, which was being used in stark contrast to Trump's attitude towards dogs and lack of a dog as a companion in the House. So I think that there was just so much pressure put on a dog that really needed more than being forced into the spotlight in that way.
Rebecca, you're a genius, because here we are discussing, I wonder what changed, and you hit the nail on the head. FDR was the end of the more radical pets. It was also the end of privacy in the White House. I mean, FDR was the first president videotaped and photographed in like the norm. And I think you just hit the nail on the head, is that something that changed, that shifted, was the scrutiny of the public eye. So a lot more of these animals existed, but it was a photo op. You know, it was the Coolidge's was a raccoon. Like, I mean, it was something more staged, and they had a lot more say and a lot more relationship with the press about how they were portrayed. And it was FDR that changed. So I wonder if that is a piece of all of this, is that the perception that can be recorded and can be blown out of proportion is not what I want to say, but that's what's popping in my head. But at least in one way or another, perceived maybe not in the best light, maybe one of the reasons that this has been significantly sterilized because it's so hyper-analyzed. So amazing. Oh my gosh. Boom.
I think too, I don't want to say we're not expecting emotional labor from other species, because of course we are, but the two alligators that you mentioned earlier, they weren't walking around at a fancy party. But
no, they were in the bathroom, terrifying guests though.
What?
Yes, they were. They were in the bathroom.
Well, maybe that destroys my point, but I guess what I'm saying is a lot of these more non-traditional or exotics wouldn't necessarily be in a position to rip the pants off the British Prime Minister.
It's true.
But dogs are kind of placed beside
their. It's true. There were multiple situations of alligators. I know some of the alligators were in the bathtub and some of them weren't. So I think you're right. I think the later alligators were not as likely to get into trouble. Although, oh my God, Herbert Hoover owned a lot of dogs. Nobody's allowed to judge me in my number of dogs anymore, because I could be like, look, the president's had. But I think you're right. I think the alligators that were terrorizing people in the bathroom were earlier, but I'm going to double check that. I'm going to check my facts. But you make a point.
Story. But yeah, you mentioned hyenas, and I think that's another example, like probably not expected to stand beside the president while he spoke to a crowd, whereas a dog might be.
Yes.
Well, no, I was going to say, it's all linked back to that over-romanticization of dogs in general, of this voluntary need to just be wonderful all the time and be our best friends and behave and be obedient. And then when they step just a tiny bit over that line, or they let their mask crack the tiniest bit, even if under those circumstances, a human might be stressed and we would understand that they would be stressed in that situation. If a dog does it, I feel like there's so much more pressure behind that. Whereas like with the hyena, it's like, oh, well, it's a hyena. You wouldn't expect a hyena to just be well-behaved. So with the dog, there's that extra oomph behind it.
You're absolutely right. And to clarify, it was John Quincy Adams's alligator given to him by the Marquis de Lafayette that was left in the bathroom to terrorize the guests. So that was a long time ago. And I mean, at that point, there was a certain amount of respect for rebelliousness. I mean, that was when the United States was breaking away and trying to declare their independence. So I think you can sort of see the trend of being like, wah-ha-ha, I'm going to put an alligator in my bathtub, versus now where it's like, oh, the animals have to be perfect because the family has to be perfect and composed, and we can't deviate from that. So yeah, very interesting. Yeah,
that loops back to the whole, the Wild West versus the American dream, mm-hmm. with the picket fence and the German shepherd who's well-behaved and doesn't pull down pants of anyone and that kind of thing. So I think there is sort of that pattern there. And as Molly said, you know, hopefully one of the listeners will know more about this than we do and can share some mm-hmm. more info about that. But it seems like there must be something to that pattern.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. I do wonder what the future holds for animals in the White House. I mean, there's that, like you guys are talking about, that effort of having a shelter animal, being more inclusive, supporting more of these, non-perfect, non-pedigree dogs and cats. And then on the same token, right now, the big cats bill is what's trying to get passed. So there's that effort of not necessarily having at least large exotic cats as pets. So I wonder what the shift is going to look like. Is it going to continue to be dogs and cats, or is there going to be a trend of no animals? Like, what, I wonder where that's going to go.
Well, and I wondered, I'm just, this is a crazy one, but I'm just going to throw it out there and go for it. But I wonder if at some point, it might be far in the future, if there would be a robot companion. So like, if would we go to like AI, and if we did, how would we feel about that? Like, would that be more of a something that people think, oh, this is like cold, like there isn't that personal touch? Or would we see it as, oh, we're moving forward? I don't know, what do you guys think about that?
It's interesting, because it could be seen as progression, like leading mm-hmm. technological progression. But I do think that it might be something that develops as an expectation alongside still having a non-human companion. Because I do think that a lot of people judge empathy and other positive characteristics based on whether or not someone has, dogs especially, and how they interact with that dog. Like, TMF found the other day, it was really interesting, a video of the Irish president with mm-hmm. his dog and trying to give a talk while this dog like chewed on his hand trying to get attention. And it was so sweet. And the comment section was filled with people saying, look how amazing he is. He has such a good relationship with his dog. He's such a wonderful leader. And it really got me thinking about how we ascribe qualities to people based on the way they interact with non-human animals. So while I think we might still see technological advancement, I don't necessarily see a time when we lose that desire to see a nice, well-behaved dog beside a political leader.
Yeah,
like we as a society.
I think it would definitely split the crowd. I think for folks like us, I would see it as that. I would see a lack of emotional attachment, which is what we treasure so much in those things, where we saw Mr. Higgins, like the Irish president with his dog. And when I rewatched that clip today before this podcast, I was like, what is it about this that I'm, besides being a dog person, besides loving other animals, like what is it really that made me go, oh, like he must be a really great president, and that sort of, you know, reaction to it. And it wasn't just that the dog was as cute as all heck. It wasn't just that the guy was being nice to, that the president was being nice to him and they were having a nice communication, but there was also this level of trust and that this patience. So you saw the trust that he knew the dog wasn't just going to run off, because there wasn't a collar, there wasn't a leash, there wasn't this strictness or this rigidness in their behavior. And it was this sort of patient, like, oh, I'll just pet you and keep you entertained with my hand and all of that while I talk at this, in front of all these folks, and I won't be bothered by you being just a puppy and being who you are. And I think that was what was endearing. So if we didn't have that, and it was just this, I don't know, robot dog with red eyes that blinked or something, you know, that wouldn't have that impact. But I would see how some people might see it as being, you know, oh, we're moving up. We look what we have now. We have these robotic dogs, and it would shine that light on them. Like Rebecca was saying, that public perception, you know, shining the light on shelter dogs, shining the light on certain breeds over others, like with Barack Obama's dogs, that all of a sudden everyone's getting Portuguese water dogs, you know, all these things, that it's really impacting more than just that, more than just the image. It's impacting like people's actions around it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went digging to see what Canada's current prime minister had in terms of non-human companions, and they've got a couple adorable long-haired guinea pigs, but when he was elected, he didn't actually have a dog yet. And shortly after being elected, he visited the White House and met Obama's Portuguese water dogs, and that's the breed they decided to go with. And I thought that was quite interesting, because it made me question what it was about the breed. Did he just really like the dogs and went, well, I don't know much about dogs, so I'm going to go with this breed? Or did he like the appearance of them? Did he feel like there was something to be gained by getting the same kind of dog as the president in terms of diplomacy and political relationships? Mm-hmm. Like, what was the motivation there? And so I just think that it's interesting to see how even among the leaders, these are very conscious choices. Mm-hmm. It's not just picking the dog that you get along with best in the shelter. And then I question Major too. Major is a German Shepherd, not a mutt, if you will, or a mix of several breeds, or unidentified, because there's so much mixing, but a gorgeous looks like purebred German Shepherd. So is there still a status association with that? Is there still a reason that of all of the possible rescues that could have been chosen, that was the one? So I really think that there's an aesthetic component too. There's an appearances component. And so often we see purebreds, even this huge shift to see a rescue in the White House being a big deal, it's still like a very prestigious looking dog.
Or even, I mean, coming back to the Trump thing again, but even the absence of one. Oh, I don't need a dog to win over, in inverted commas, the people or my people, as he worded it. That is, despite folks saying and his team that it would be great for him to get a dog for his image, him consciously declining and not wanting to have that image of a dog next to him. And I wonder why that is. Like, does it take the attention away from him? Does it make it seem like he's dependent on the dog's image to gain greater following or to change opinions about him? He was getting a lot of negative feedback about not having a dog, right? Being the first one in however many hundred years or something to not have a companion. That's interesting too, I think, like the absence of one, like choosing that.
It is super interesting about the absence, because I guess it's a gamble, and maybe it's a gamble well played, because certainly plenty of politicians have lost a significant amount of respect for being kind of, well, for lack of a better term, dumb around animals, whether it was how much trouble Nixon got in for, or no, wasn't Nixon, which I'm trying to remember which president tried to pick up a beagle by the ears. Was a thing. Yeah, I'm going to find that while we're talking. But also, I mean, when Romney was running for president, he transported a dog in a crate outside of his vehicle, on top of his vehicle. And that was also not received well. Right. So I think it's a calculated risk. If you do something perceived as inhumane to an animal and you are a political, especially a presidential figure, that's going to, you know, that possibly could ruin it for you. So I think if you can't be trusted with it, then probably you shouldn't have it, which I think is also just sound advice in the first place.
To me, that really came back to Clinton Sanders wrote a really great article about those different identities we have. And in that case, it had to do with guide dogs, but it rings true for all, like your social identity, your personal identity, and that social identity of that embarrassment when your dog companion misbehaves. And personally, this is just a personal opinion, but I would think with Trump that, you know, having a dog not behave for him would send that message of, oh, I was not powerful in that situation. I was not in control. And what would that send to, again, in inverted commas, my people? That was something that really got to me when I was reading up, painfully reading up on a little bit of his situation and his opinion about dogs and a few reports of how dogs reacted to him that maybe he, I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was Ivanka Trump, but don't quote me on that, reporting that her dog did not react well to Trump. So maybe him knowing that, oh, I've had a bad experience with this before, how would this look in front of the people, my people? And that identity, like that, this would be how I'm coming into the situation. It would be embarrassing. It would be making me less powerful.
At least yeah. So here's the interesting overlap. So it was LBJ that got in trouble for picking up his beagle by the ears, but he was a president that did that, exuded that power and that control. And so what's interesting is that the campaign after he got in trouble, well, after he was photographed doing that, or it was just like, you know, just this anger, how infuriated, but basically, so the dog's name was Him, first of all, which is super interesting, just in that relationship.
Care about the pronouns, I see.
Yeah, but what's really disturbing is apparently that LBJ hated how much attention the dog got, which right. I think is also very interesting. But then apparently, so Him was killed when he was hit by a car by a Secret Service agent in 1966. And again, like LBJ was like, I've got to be stoic. I can't act like it mattered. You know, it's super, but again, that was the presence that president brought, that was his whole purpose, is like, I'm dealing with a war. Like I have to be this. And maybe that was his personality. I mean, it was certainly before my time, but it's super interesting, that overlap of being like, oh yeah, I don't care. Pick my dog up by the ears. And oh yeah, it died, whatever. I hate the fact that it receives more attention than I deserve. So
super. And that's what I see with Trump as well, that I would assume that he would have that approach as well, in terms of that image of like, oh, if he's here, then that would be less on me. Or if he misbehaves, it would be on him and my lack of whatever with him. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's some connection there in terms of their personalities, and if there is that, something could be, maybe some future research could look into that in terms of presidential personalities, the personality tests, and seeing what types of animals they live with, as well as like how they treat them and how they, or if they decide not to, the overlap there.
Mm-hmm.
I do think you're right, though, that it was strategic of Trump not to bring a dog into the White House, because, like you said, it would affect, if he was unable to handle it well, it would affect the perception of him as cold and problematic, and his long list of isms that he was already being critiqued for. But with his own supporters, who appreciated and attached to all those things that others would find problematic, if he couldn't manage the dog right, that would affect his appearance as like a strong, powerful COVID survivor to those people. So I think he realized he kind of wouldn't win. There was nothing positive for him about bringing a dog into the space. And that makes me think back to, who was it, Molly, that you said had like an entire zoo?
Couple of them.
Wow.
I mean, we know that Roosevelt had a zoo, and I mean, let's see, and Coolidge had a, I mean, they define it as literally, they say that he quite literally had a zoo at the White House. Apparently he had a pygmy hippo and a wallaby and some lion cubs. But it's one of the interesting things is that a few times Congress has said, no, you should not keep that at the White House. You need to send it to an actual zoo. So
wonder what those animals are.
Sometimes. What was that?
I wonder what those animals are. Like, if you're going to allow the pygmy hippo and the wallaby and the lion cubs, like, what is the animal they didn't allow in then?
So two Sumatran tigers were sent to a zoo. Those were not acceptable. Most of Teddy Roosevelt's bears were sent to zoos, as far as I can find.
Most of his bears.
Technically the pygmy hippo did not live at the White House, but was quickly sent to the National Zoo. So part of me wonders if half the National Zoo has just been remnants of presidential pets. That seems like a thing here. So I would like to know where, but like I, you know, you're saying, I'd like to know where the line is. Like, what is allowed on
the line? House
and what has to go to the National Zoo?
Well, and how has that line shifted over time, right? Yes. Like, we're kind of looking at a very different situation. But I think the collections like that, and I mean, I feel similarly about roadside exotic animal collections. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's very much a human dominion and power thing. So I question if a lot of these acquisitions were as a result of trying to demonstrate that power, that stature. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm strong enough to lead because I have six bears.
I have six bears, exactly. Yeah.
It's true. And I always felt Roosevelt was fascinating in the, well, this is Teddy, not FDR. Teddy Roosevelt was always fascinating because he was a big game hunter, but on the same token, he also wanted to own, share his life with, I don't know to what degree he felt emotional attachment to these animals, but some he kept alive, some he hunted. And interestingly enough, fun fact, it was a dinner table conversation that led to the creation of the Bronx Zoo. He was literally sitting there having dinner with some people and was like, we should have a zoo in New York City. So it's just interesting how these institutions that are now part of conservation came out of these powerful presidential figures who actually felt animals were important in their lives, whether it was to hunt them or, you know, to use them to show power or to just have. I think it's super fascinating. I was just now trying to figure out if the zebra actually lived on the White House lawn or not. There's so much overlap with different critters. I mean, it's funny because, you know, we did this piece on non-traditional pets and you talked about snakes, Rebecca, and how, you know, that's odd to a lot of people. But I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, I mean, Roosevelt's daughter had a garter snake, of all things, named Emily Spinach. It was a garter snake.
Okay.
So, I mean, women owning snakes in powerful positions was a thing. So yeah, it's just interesting. This historical thing. I mean, there were roosters, a lot of parrots during the late 1800s. I love the names of some of these animals, like Benjamin Harrison's possums were named Mr. Reciprocity and Mr. Protection.
There's nothing political about that.
No, nothing at all.
Another shift I found interesting was the fact that a lot of the earlier presidents we're talking about received these animals as gifts. Mm-hmm. But now that's not really a thing in the same way. Like, they're bringing their own dogs in and recalling back to the diplomatic gift of two pandas from China to Canada. They didn't go live with Trudeau. They went to our zoo. Mm. So even though animals are still being used as diplomatic gifts, it's kind of contextually different now. And I wonder if that also comes with, like Molly, you were saying, the shift in public perception. Not to say that Trudeau would have just kept the pandas, but it makes me question if part of why that level of animal companionship in the White House has changed is largely because the care that these animals require really wasn't being administrated properly. And nowadays, we would all know about it. As soon as an animal is mistreated in a position that's that public, we would all know about it. It would be all over the internet. There'd be words. Mm-hmm. Animal would probably be taken away from the person. Like, there's so much more there now. But I really am interested in the fact that a lot of these bears were gifts, that the raccoon that was meant to be Thanksgiving dinner was a gift. Because we don't really think about that anymore when it comes to what animals the politicians have.
Yeah. And gifting's like a taboo, like the whole don't give an animals a gift for Christmas. Animals are not toys for Easter. So that shift in perspective, whereas, yeah, let's give you a raccoon for dinner, or let's give you bears and leave them on the front. Thomas Jefferson had grizzly bears that lived in a cage on the front lawn of the White House for 3 months before they figured out where to put them. So, I mean, that would have been completely inhumane and cruel if that was in the news today. You'd have Tiger King White House edition, I feel like, is where we'd be headed. So, yeah.
I hate to say it, but I would watch that. I would definitely watch. I would consume that. And I would feel guilty about it, but
I think also, I mean, when I was searching presidential pets and you're typing in presidential animals, dogs and and not specifying White House. And even when you type in United Kingdom, Europe, Russia, like all these different places, they still pull up, for the most part, animals in the White House. So I don't know if that's just it could be my algorithm. It could be that they're just going into the news more, that in the States, there's more of a hoopla about it, that it's getting shared more often, or if it's just not as big of a thing elsewhere, if that's that cultural aspect coming in again. So I'm not sure. I mean, we saw the one from Higgins in Ireland, and there was some talk about the dogs in France and in the Netherlands. But there wasn't much that I found elsewhere as much as there was in the States. So I found that interesting as well in terms of the cultural side of things.
It is. It's interesting. Is it that the US is just unique in one, its collection, and also the fact that it matters and that so many of our officials have them? Or is it the news and how it's perceived? I mean, we were chatting about this before. I think it was interesting that popped up about falconry and the how important that is in the Middle East, and how, you know, having those birds or even having big cats is something that occurs out there, but it doesn't come up in search results the same way unless you go digging. So it is interesting how that comes up.
I wonder too if that's partially a culture of media consumption. Mm-hmm. And again, it could largely be my algorithm. Yeah. So I don't want to speak too positivistically about this, but I do feel like there's a lot more voyeurism when it comes to the American leadership. And I don't know, maybe I wasn't paying enough attention pre-Trump, but it feels like there's a lot of headlines and discourse about the American leadership that feels more akin to a debrief after a reality show airs than you really get from the energy of posts that are about, or articles that are about the UK leadership, for example. So I find that quite interesting as well. I wonder if there's more pressure in the role of the US president to have that kind of a public persona, to have an acceptable presentation, I guess, and how that includes non-human animals has shifted over time, but I feel like it has always included it.
Definitely, yeah. I think the role media and social media, but also the media more largely, including the news and everything, the role that has on that, you know, not just that they have these animals, but how the media is presenting it, like with Major. Oh, you know, aggressively bit so-and-so, even though there was no puncture wound or anything, he didn't draw any blood. With Obama's dogs, you know, it became this whole thing. I remember like, oh, the best family dog ever, and everyone's out. And this dog that no one ever really talked about as much suddenly became so popular. Probably mostly through the media. Like we were saying before, like you mentioned, Rebecca, there must have been dog bites that we just didn't hear about because of that absence of media and the absence of tweeting about it and sharing those photos so quickly. So yeah, definitely. And how being used like those political chips as well. That's what I find fascinating, that you're having them there as that's your image of being, you know, the first president with that shelter dog.
Well, that's what I mean, is I think if it were a different dog that had that incident occur, it's possible it wouldn't have been broadcast. You know, it would have just not swept under the rug necessarily, but treated as less of an issue.
I think politically also it's that contrast with Trump not having a dog and then someone coming in with the first shelter dog that I think I wonder if that heightened it in any way. And also just politically where we're at right now, that we're like, oh, we have this, I guess we're just over romanticizing it because we're like, oh, this is such a step up from where we were. But I wonder if there is that sort of underlying factor of, oh, we have the president now who has a shelter dog and you know, this, that messaging, if that is in any way present.
I would say that's absolutely a factor. I mean, Biden's not exactly radical progressive, but when compared to Trump, he's far less dangerous. And I think that adding the layer of, look, he's such a good person, he even rescues dogs, to that, mm-hmm. kind of, like we were saying, it increased the expectations on Major too, mm-hmm. to be that perfect, well-behaved presidential pet, despite whatever his background is, how his training and socialization has been since he was adopted, etc. We're not really seeing any of that. All we're seeing is this beautiful moment where our new empathy-filled president of the United States comes in with a shelter dog and then it bites someone. So I think that incident is also heavily contrasted with how much of a big deal this shelter dog was, how much it was blown up in media as this huge important thing, this indicator of how much better things were going to be now with this new president. It was like Major became a tool for Biden to really, really push how different he was from Trump.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite interesting.
And it is, again, that classic, the American dream, the family, the house, the German Shepherd, honestly, in my opinion, pops up as that dog that you would have in that house. German Shepherd or Labrador, but essentially those classic breeds and also what German Shepherds stand for as well, when you're especially following Trump, not wanting to like overwork that comparison, but I think there is that contrast there, that you have a dog like a German Shepherd come in, whereas if it was like a Yorkie or something, it would just be different. And in terms of how we're seeing them, it's almost like that, the working dog, right? The working people, the working dog. And at least with my research with emotional labor and dogs, it's definitely German Shepherds are of those working breeds, in that case, guide dogs, definitely perform more emotional labor with those expectations placed on them. So I think there's definitely something to that. It's like a double-edged sword in a way.
Yeah, so thank you for joining us. We're going to post a couple of links in the description for this, including that video we were discussing about the Irish president, even just so you can see how freaking adorable it is. And yeah, if you have any comments on this or you know anything further that's maybe a factor we haven't considered in how we perceive presidential pets, definitely comment. We'd love to explore this further. So signing off for myself, Tiamat and Molly, thank you for joining us.